What's the impact of COVID-19 infection on healthcare workers' mental health?
Patients admitted to the ICU with COVID infections.
What's the best treatment for knee osteoarthritis?
And are cotton masks protective against COVID infection?
That's what we're talking about this week on Double T Health Watch, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a Baltimore-based medical journalist.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Let's keep with our COVID theme here and also acknowledge that there is other stuff going on in medical literature. So we're going to end today with a study relative to the treatment of knee osteoarthritis in the New England Journal of Medicine. But first, let's turn to Annals of Internal Medicine, one that I sort of stumbled over where I said, hey, what's the impact of COVID-19 infection on healthcare workers' mental health? And this is a look in Singapore at the psychological impact of this pandemic on healthcare workers. What they did is they asked 470 healthcare workers to fill out questionnaires relative to their mental health, and they were looking as a primary outcome at the prevalence of depression, stress, anxiety, and PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, among all healthcare workers. They looked at the what are called often ancillary folks who are also a part of the healthcare system, and said, what is the impact of this thing on both those who are at the front lines and those who are not? In this case, they had 68% females. They came from all variety of the healthcare system, physicians, nurses, technicians, clerical staff, administration. They looked at the several instruments and they found that about 14.5% of them screened positive for anxiety, about 9% for depression, 7% for stress, and about 8% for clinical concern of post-traumatic stress disorder. The prevalence of anxiety was higher among the non-medical healthcare workers than it was among the medical personnel, almost 21% versus about 11%. They say that these findings are consistent with those of a recent COVID-19 study demonstrating that frontline nurses, interestingly, had significantly lower vicarious traumatization scores than non-frontline nurses and the general public. And I think this is true even in my own experience. I find that being in the hospital and watching the hospital move through its paces is reassuring. And I think it's not so reassuring when you're just speculating on what's going on. So I guess I'm not surprised by this prevalence. And they suggest that perhaps transparency among all of the folks in the healthcare system relative to the situation might be helpful.
They also kind of compare this to the anxiety depression scores that were recorded during the SARS outbreak previously. They reported that in the COVID-infected time period that there was less anxiety and depression and PTSD. And that may be because we've had more time to prepare for this and because in Singapore they've had very stringent infection control measures that may have lowered the anxiety. But your point's well taken in that the people on the front line oftentimes have psychological support and co-worker support. And sometimes the people that are one step removed either don't have all the information or they don't see what's going on or they don't have the same type of support. So they have more anxiety. And therefore, we need to put more effort to making sure that their needs are addressed, just like the people on the front line.
I agree. And I think also we need to be vigilant once this pandemic dies down in detecting and helping with PTSD.
I think it does demonstrate is that we need to concentrate not only on those on the front line, but those that are stepped removed.
Let's turn to the Journal of the American Medical Association, and that's all up to you.
This is a retrospective study of almost 1,600 consecutive patients that had laboratory-confirmed COVID infection that were referred for ICU admission. In Italy, this is a 72-hospital network. This is the largest cohort of ICU hospitalized patients has been reported to date. The mean age of the patients was 63, and by the way, that was the mean age of individuals who got infected in Italy. About 82% of the individuals that were in the ICU were male. About two-thirds of them had at least one comorbidity, the most common one being hypertension. 99% of the individuals needed some sort of respiratory support, and that's because the reason they ended up in the ICU was because they had hypoxic respiratory distress. Disconcertingly, Interestingly, almost 90% of the patients in the ICU needed mechanical ventilation, and only about 10% received non-invasive ventilation. 26% mortality rate, only about 16% of the patients were discharged, and at the time of the study, about 60% of the patients were still in the ICU.
Another study that also looks at the Italian experience retrospectively suggests that the age of the folks in Italy, the comorbidities, the history of cigarette smoking, all of these things contributed to this high mortality that they're reporting. And this mortality might actually be higher because so many people who get on ventilators remain on ventilators for a long time when they have COVID-19 infection.
When you take a look at the entire Italian population, those that are COVID confirmed, about 10% of them ended up in the ICU. And you're right, because of the overwhelming admission rate, it may be that many of the patients that received non-invasive ventilation never made it to the ICU. They were just managed on floors capable of doing it.
Of course, this is of concern to all of us, too. Let's turn, since you're also talking about the other one, from JAMA to the other study relative to COVID-19.
This was a study trying to determine whether face masks that are worn by patients with coronavirus disease actually prevent contamination of the environment. They took four patients that were in the hospital with known COVID infection, and they put a petri dish with a little bit of medium for culturing the virus about 8 inches from their face. And they had these individuals cough 5 times into the petri dish, and they cultured virus. And then they had those same individuals wear a surgical mask, then a cotton mask, and then they had them again wear no mask. And for each of these times, they had them cough 5 times. What they discovered was that when they collected the virus with no mask and compared it to the times the individuals either wore the surgical mask or cotton mask, there was a slight decline in the number of viruses that were cultured, but not a significant decline. Their conclusion is that neither surgical nor cotton mask effectively filtered COVID virus during coughs by infected patients. All right, so let's take a step back for a second. First of all, there's a positive information about these particular masks, and we know that some masks are better at filtering than others, but they in fact do filter some viruses. Secondly, the petri dish was placed 8 inches from the person's face, and they cough 5 times vigorously. This doesn't simulate the normal circumstance, and it certainly doesn't simulate what happens when we have social isolation. Previous studies have shown that in fact the mask does decrease the projection distance when someone is coughing. Finally, this really doesn't address whether it decreases or increases infectivity. An interesting study, contrived experiences, and may not be directly applicable.
And I would just remind everyone, and you too, that you called it last week with regard to the use of masks everywhere by everybody. There's also something that's on the CDC website that talks about best materials to use to construct your own mask. And we know that there are multiple benefits of wearing masks. So I would certainly not allow this study to discourage that practice.
That's why I thought it was important to discuss it, because when you hear it on the news, some people are going to be dissuaded from wearing masks. I think that's the wrong message.
Well, I think we should turn to this study from the New England Journal of Medicine on the best management of knee osteoarthritis, just because we are feeling hopeful that this pandemic is going to end and some of these other things that impact on people's daily lives are really going to once again come to the fore. On that note of hope, let's look at this study. They took a look at 156 patients with a mean age of 56 years, and this is something that I would point to as, I'm wondering if that's necessarily representative. But what they did was take 78 patients and form two groups, one of whom received a glucocorticoid injection of their knee, and the other of whom received physical therapy. They followed these people for a year. The injection was one thing. They could actually have a follow-up injection. The physical therapy took a lot longer, included instructions and images for exercises, joint mobilization, so hands-on by the physical therapist, an explanation of the clinical reasoning underlying these particular practices, dosing and progression of treatment. So it was pretty intense. They had 8 treatment sessions over an initial 4 to 6 week period, and then the patient could attend an additional 1 to 3 sessions at the 4-month and 9-month reassessments if that plan of care was agreed on by the physical therapist and the patient. As I said, they followed these patients out for a year, and they used something that's called a WOMAC score, which has been reported many times to help to assess what's the change that happens as a result of the intervention. A 12 to 16% improvement from baseline is considered to be successful. Basically, what they found was that the physical therapy was significantly better than the injection into the knee. There was a mean between group difference of 18.8 points, which I think is really significant. And secondary outcomes followed that same direction as that of the primary outcome, which is that the patient actually reported that they liked it better. They had only one, what they would noteworthily call a negative outcome, which is one patient fainted while receiving the glucocorticoid injection.
When faced with a choice between getting steroid injection or physical therapy, about half the patients in the U.S. with osteoarthritis end up with a steroid injection. The thought being is, well, you'll receive better relief early on, and it may be just as good as physical therapy. Well, in fact, what the study showed was that both groups, those that have physical therapy and those that receive a steroid injection, had significant improvement at the four-week period. But then when you followed it over the course of the following year, people in the physical therapy group did better. In fact, when they queried the individuals, about 23% in the steroid group and 10% in the physical therapy group reported no perceived improvement.
Yeah. And also, as we're both aware, sometimes people get more than one injection when they have these kinds of conditions. And they cite some of those potential complications, including infection, accelerated degradation of the articular cartilage in the knee, and subchondral insufficiency fractures. I think that PT just emerges as the hands-down winner.
It does, and obviously there were no ill side effects associated with physical therapy. Obviously, this is the treatment of choice, in my opinion.
On that note, let's turn to what's going on at Texas Tech and how y'all are managing.
Since last week, we have a relatively slow increase in the number of COVID infections until yesterday, where it dramatically increased. So I think we're on the upward curve now. Here in El Paso, we're sitting at 158, but we're seeing an increasing number admitted to the hospital and to the ICUs. We're still competing with other localities, regions across the U.S. with regard to PPE. We'll order it and it just doesn't come in, or we'll get a smaller amount than we anticipated because it's being diverted to other areas around the country.
I guess one thing I'm interested in is how you feel the mental health really is among your healthcare workforce.
I think it ends up being a significant issue. We're addressing it not only to the health workers on the front line, but those that are second removed, and even our students. It's particularly a difficult time because the hospitals are closed to visitors. Those healthcare workers that are caring for these individuals, the individuals are isolated. Their only interactions are with the healthcare workers. If the individuals are on a ventilator or in the midst of dying, the people that witness this and provide comfort and support aren't the family, they're the healthcare providers. And then we have healthcare providers that are being isolated. They're being sent home because they've been exposed without wearing the proper PPE occasionally. And then there's just a fatigue factor as well.
Talk to me about the availability of testing.
The availability of testing is still quite limited. As a result, we prioritize those patients that are hospitalized, those that are about to be hospitalized, and healthcare workers. But it's interesting in that most of the spread isn't occurring in the hospital setting. It's actually in the community. And the lack of testing has made it difficult to identify patients that are mildly symptomatic or asymptomatic that need to be isolated from the population. So it's a significant issue across the United States, but particularly here in El Paso.
On that note, no doubt we'll be visiting this issue again next week. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Friesen.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.